Hey, everybody, welcome back to Little Things Are Big Things Education Podcast. We're here on our big idea in Failing is Learning Week, and we're super excited about the conversation we're going to continue having from Tuesday. In this episode, you can expect to hear all sorts of stuff about how the experience of life can be one of our greatest teachers, and more specifically, it can be the greatest opportunity for growth. We're going to talk about the importance of building a very safe learning environment, so like a safe space to fail, and how that time that it takes to build that can reap like massive growth later and rewards, kind of like bamboo. And we're going to finish up with an idea from Will Smith talking about this failing often, fail faster, fail forwards kind of idea, which in addition to the idea of how fast bamboo grows and how long it takes to kind of like culture that learning and growing space, like the two of those together can be kind of a sweet 1-2 combo for you. And then just for fun at the end, you get to hear my story about losing $30,000.
All right, folks, he's coming to you live from Bowling Green, Kentucky, with the same energy of all four of his golden retrievers wrapped up into one body. He's got 7 years teaching math, 3 years working with Challenge Day and tutoring one-on-one through it all. My best friend and an awesome teacher, T-Free.
And K-Dub's coming to you live from the Pacific Northwest. It's, I think, been gorgeous there for the last little week, so we're not even talking sogginess, although we still want to prevent people from going to the PNW, right?
Like, this just is true. Yes. Stay away. Stay away.
The house prices are already out of control.
That is true.
11 years of teaching social studies, middle school and high school, 20 years of coaching, pretty much everything and anything under the sun. My best bud, K-Dub.
Folks, thanks for listening to Little Things Are Big Things Education, brought to you by Peak State Mathematics. Don't forget to rate and review us. We'd love to hear from you at littlebiged.com. We are available wherever you are getting your podcasts, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube. Tim, did I miss anything?
I think Apple.
Oh, Apple. Duh.
We're not Apple people. It's okay.
It's okay. This week's big idea is the idea that failing is actually a form of learning. You got anything you want to kick us off with?
The idea, right, in general, that like that's the message. It's like when we fail, we learn. And if we don't learn from our failure, right, that isn't that the old definition of insanity, like doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results? Like, Why do I keep getting my butt kicked? Oh, because I keep doing the same thing where I get my butt kicked. Like, failing is the ultimate opportunity for growth and learning, but it's also it requires work, right? Like, it requires awareness. So I love it. Failing is definitely a mindset like shift to being okay with it. But it's one of my favorite things now. Like when I get my butt kicked, like the first thing that comes to my mind is what did I learn from that? And I try to teach that inside the classroom too.
And I think that's why I think something that has changed for both of us over time is like we've known each other for quite some time now is one of the things that we used to have in common is we used to be like those just like constant go, 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 go all the time people. And we had lots of ideas and we were just going. And we have both gotten much better. I know you have, and I'm pretty sure I have. I hope I have at pressing pause and reflecting, which is something that we've talked about before on the podcast. And so I will say very quickly as a part of talking about failure is a form of learning where learning is failing. You have to be reflective in order for that to be true. Your comment about like, the definition of insanity. I think of another line of like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. It's kind of that same thought process of if I don't learn from the thing that happened, then that's like at some point that's our fault. But again, the learning takes place, or at least what I would call the higher form of learning, or the higher order learning, is from making an attempt, realizing that it didn't go well, and then figuring out a solution to that.
Right. And I think that's why I like to talk about it is like the opportunity for learning comes from right. And that opportunity to reflect on what happened and what I can do maybe on the next go round. So, I think for me, like, I would argue to say the things I remember the most are not the things that I did correctly on the first attempt, but the things that I eventually figured out how to do. And then I understood why the way I'm doing it now is effective, because I learned all the ways that weren't effective that got me there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I always liken this to a video game. I use this analogy with my athletes more than I do with my students. But we talk about, like, the things that you are going to get the most enjoyment out of are the things that you had to work harder for, right? The things that were a little bit more difficult. And the analogy that I always use, like, most of the kids coaching football, as the primary sport that I've coached, most of the kids play Madden. And it's like, how good do you feel when you win by 40 playing Madden on rookie versus when you turn Madden to all pro and you have a good season, or like you actually feel like you've accomplished something in that case versus just like, well, I had it set to the easiest level. Of course I did well. That's that same thought process of what you're talking about, where if you're doing something hard enough where there's going to be some failure in it, you're going to feel better once you finally get it right.
Yeah. That man, that's even good too. Like this idea of resistance creating growth. And like, it makes me think obviously of weight training, right? Like the reps that make us the strongest are not the first couple reps or when we're doing super lightweight, high reps. It's that last one where you're like, it's on your chest and your buddy's like just keeping you from dying, but you're still struggling to get it all the way up. And every muscle is just trembling as you get it all the way up and rack it. And you're like, or that last gasser where they're like, 17, 18, you're going to do another one, 19. You like stumble through the line right before the 20 call comes out, you know? And like, you're like, oh my gosh, I thought I was going to die. And then you win. And so now you're like there's so much growth there. So
there is
failing and then hitting the wall and fighting resistance and then coming back again and hitting it again. Like, oh my gosh, like there's so much good in all of that.
I was reminded when you were talking of like an old, like clearly like this is us getting older example of this is like when the IKEA piece of furniture finally comes together after trying to figure out all the damn instructions and why is this piece here?
Why do I have one missing piece?
That was just another thing I could think of like that, like, even though it's not like that hard of a thing, right? But it is like this common struggle and like that moment of like, I did it. Right. Is another one. And it's a really great loop back into the idea of failure is learning, because the first few times that I tried to build something from IKEA, like it seemed straightforward, right? You look at the directions, they look pretty straightforward. This is going to be easy, right? And you like,
four grab pictures, four instructions, couch is made.
Easy. So let's just, you know, let's have a beverage and get to work here, right? And
right.
And like, oh, I can crack this out in an hour, right? This will be done in a minute. And then you're, you know, the frustration level. So like the learning from that is like, okay, this is misleading. This is going to take me a minute. I need to be in the appropriate headspace to start this project. Right. And I need to give myself plenty of time.
And the fact that you game planned an hour in that example, I was like, come on, you know, you really were like, I'll be done in 20 minutes.
Fair. Yeah.
That's why you cracked a beverage.
Yes.
You're like, I'm going to be great. Wait, 2 hours later and six beverages. I don't even know where the last screw goes. That's why I have the extra piece.
Damn it. So yeah, I think that leads me to one of probably the biggest thing that I think about when I think about failure is learning. There's this phrase out there, right, that experience is the world's greatest teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not 100% on board with that statement because it's a little bit absolutist for me. But what I always kind of caveat that with is like the experience that teaches you is when you screw up, right? Like the guy who took 100 reps with no issues and then, like, you didn't learn much from those 100 reps, but if you took 100 reps and you were like, oh, I got to bring that down a little bit, I got to bring it a little to the left, I got to move my foot like this a little bit, right? Like, that's the person who's learning from their experience.
Right.
It's the person who's making mistakes from their experience and then applying the lessons from those mistakes to future attempts.
Right. Well, I hate that there's, like, such a stigma attached to this because, like, there is – The greatest growth usually comes from the person who started the furthest away from the target, right? And so I always think of, you know, the most improved player award, right?
Yeah.
It's usually your kid that just got crapped on early in the season and like actually like was super resilient through all of it and turned into a pretty gosh darn good player. Maybe not your top star stud, right? Mm-hmm. But they came so far because all of life's experiences and trial and error and learning from what happened and what I need to do next time. And you're like, holy crap, you grew a ton. So yeah, I 100% agree with that. And I hate that there's such this negative stigma to the idea of the most improved person. It's like, oh, well, you won that because you weren't very good, you know? And it's like, no, I won that because I worked my tail off and I learned from my experiences. And I wish that that was the meaning that was attached to it instead of, oh, we gave it to the worst player because they, you know, they became decent, you know? So,
yeah. And like a quick side plug to anyone who's a coach who's listening to this, don't call it your most improved player award. Like, it's just a simple wordsmith. So like for us, like that award, we give it to that same kind of kid, but we make it, depending on the program I've been in, it's been like the Highlander Award, or like when my first head coaching job, there had been a kid who was like, he was a really good athlete. Like he was a college football player, but he died of cancer before he even finished his college career. But he had always been that hardworking, first in, last out, always helping other people kind of guy. And so we just called it the Bumgarner Award, and that was for the kid who modeled all of those things, right? So we just took the label off, right? It wasn't about being the most improved and being that kid who was maybe not that great, but like the coach's favorite or ever, but just, you know, the kid who lives by the values that you're preaching in your program. That's, you know, that's basically what that award is. It's the kid who's utilizing that more than anybody else is. So that's a quick plug for, you know, just don't call it the most improved award then. So right. I think the other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about the stigma that's attached to that is, and I'm wondering if it's the same at your school, because our schools are very different from a demographic standpoint.
Right.
There was a huge stigma around the idea of failure.
Yes.
At my school. And I really don't know if it's a generational thing, if it's just being older and looking back at younger kids with a different perspective. Being older, right, it's hard to really be in your 17-year-old brain when you're not 17 anymore. Right. But, like, we have a lot of kids who simply won't try.
Right.
If they think they might fail, right? It, like, there's a legitimate, like, it's better to not try than to fail mindset at our school.
I would agree. And, yeah, we have completely different demographics. And from the different schools I've even gone into with all of Challenge Day the last 4 or 5 years, like there was a general vibe, I would say almost countrywide, where it was better for me to keep my mouth shut than to raise my hand, take a shot, and have the wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid who rose their hand on a regular basis had a certain reputation, right? And it was interesting how, like, again, all these labels and meanings we attach to this is like, oh, you know, brown nose or goody two shoe, like, mm-hmm. you know, teacher's pet.
Try hard. You guys have that one?
Like, you know, nerd, you know, all the different things that kids can do and be mean. And it's better to be stupid and not try than to be wrong and learn and grow.
Yeah. Which kind of goes back to the connection activity that we talked about on Tuesday. Like a simple thing, the kid who raises their hand, like, again, just give everyone who raises their hand and makes an attempt to answer the question a dum-dum.
Right.
Or if you're doing the popsicle thing that we talked about last time, right? Like, you pull a popsicle out. Johnny, do you know the answer? Instead of saying, no, like, give it a shot. And as long as you give it a shot, you still get the, you know, hey, thanks for trying.
Right.
Kind of thing. So, yeah, I've been trying to figure out, and I by no means do I feel like I've been as successful as I would like to be with making my classroom a safe space to fail. Not only a safe space to fail, but like really like to change the mindset around like failure is productive.
Yeah.
If we utilize it correctly.
Right. Yeah. I would say building that culture is huge, and it's time consuming, and it's very intentional, and it's hard if the rest of the either school community or surrounding community does not support that as well, right? Like mm-hmm. they might feel comfortable in your class, but they know that they're safe there. But when they get outside the walls, they still might get ripped on and clowned on by their friends, mm-hmm. you know? And so like, I know for me, especially in some of my ESL groups specifically, like trying to have that conversation and catch it not only in my classroom, but catch it in the hallways and coach it in multiple places to, you know, normalize attempts, normalize not understanding, normalize the struggle to learn and acquire information and skill sets. Like, and again, it doesn't even have to be whatever's in my class. It's, you know, and those are my favorites, right? And we've talked about this several times, like wherever the student's interest goes, run with it and be like, no, that's a great question. Like, you didn't know about that. And maybe I don't even know yet either. Pull up Google. Let's ask Google. Let's go find it. Oh, sweet. I do know something about this. How is that related to this? Let's have a conversation. Oh, do you guys know what this word means? Let's go here. Right. And like, you can create that space where it's no longer just one kid getting singled out, but you kind of bounce it. And your popsicle stick idea, I love too. And I will never, not never, I will most of the time stay with a student until they finally attempt. If they don't, I say, okay, I'm going to have you call on a classmate to help you, but no, I'm coming back to you because I want you to take what you learned from their response to help you on the next one. And then two or three questions later, I make sure I slide back in at the exact same location with the exact same type of response and see if they're able to solve it. And now they get an ounce of success and it's building on what they perceived as failure and, you know, almost on the edge of they felt, you know, like they were shamed or embarrassed because that's, even if I try my hardest, I can't control how they take it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, like, I know that they're right on that; they're teetering, right? And I'll push it because I'm like, no, I'm staying with you because I know you're capable. No, I'm staying with you because I know you've seen this before. I've seen you do it in your notes. No, you can't just get off the hook because your friend's going to give you some guidance, and you're going to learn from your friend to then help yourself on the next one. You know, and so. Building that atmosphere though takes a lot of time, and that's a lot of the connection stuff that we talk about all the time on this podcast.
Well, a really powerful thing that you just mentioned that I honestly have never done before, and I've never been as thoughtful about it. Like the idea of a letting them know that you're going to come back to them, and it's off the top of my head, it feels like it's probably easier in math, but I know if I think about it long enough, I'll figure out a way to do it in social studies. Of like, not only are you going to let them know in advance, like, I am coming back to you, like, you are going to have to make a full-throated attempt here at some point, but having that re-entry point be at that moment where the struggle was and where they got to see the other person, right? So they know, like, hey, I'm going to have to do this again, and all I have to do is listen to this other person go through the process, and I can hopefully try and replicate that. And that just sounded, like, literally brilliant to me when you were saying it. I was like, holy S word, that is a great idea. I gotta write that down. So
and when I've heard you talk about your social studies class, right, you're like, oh, I want to make sure they know how to make, you know, like take information, make the argument of stance, and like do the process, right? So you know maybe you're going from one conversation where they do it with World War II, and then all of a sudden they come back at it and they do it with, you know, the next topic or a different part of World War II, wherever you're at, but it's like still using the same skill set that somebody else has set, like, assisted them in. And even, you know, and, you know, we're both sports people, so not everybody's going to reference this, but, you know, basketball, like, call in for the assist, right? Like, hey, I set you up, I almost got there.
Yeah,
finish the play. Or, you know, like, I'm have somebody else get you set up. All right, just finish it. What's the final step? What do I need to do? So yeah, there's a lot of things you can do with that and play around with it.
For our non-sports people, just think phone a friend from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Oh yeah, yeah, call in. Yeah, yeah.
One of the other things that I'm wondering about, like, in your room, right? Sorry, say that again.
I was pausing because I was like, there are so many places where we can talk about failure and experience and building the community and, like, you know, having it. It's just, it's everywhere. If we just take a moment and stop and come back to what you talked about first, right? The reflection piece. And I was reading an article actually, probably 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and I knew this was coming up later in our podcast, but it was talking about the idea of no matter what subject it is, we need to do more written reflection or auditory reflection, like a Flipgrid or something, right? Mm-hmm. But like, do these opportunities in every single subject to reflect on our learning and on our failures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that idea of like reflecting on our failures, one of the things that you mentioned earlier that I did want to circle back to, as you're right, like I'm trying to, like there's a thousand different things to talk about on this topic without having it be a 12-hour podcast. Your point about creating a safe space in your room and then how does that transfer to outside of that? I think, first of all, like as we're talking about other teachers, I would say like your job is to use a religious term, right, to evangelize this so that it's something that is hopefully going to become part of your school culture. Like we're hopefully at our school going to begin the process of like redoing our vision statement because we're starting essentially a new school next year, right? We're coming back. Half of our students have never been in the building. All the stuff I've talked about before, new name, new mascot, new principal, who was with us before the pandemic. But anyways, I'm really hoping that part of that vision talks about like failure and the resiliency of recovering from failure and those things, because it's something that I do want it to push outside of our classroom and be aware of. If you're the one place in the world or in school where kids feel like it's safe to fail, that's going to be a really, really powerful experience. And I can promise you that kids will remember your class, because like creating a safe space to fail is a really unique thing in our culture. That's, to be totally honest with you, like failing safely is not a part of like American culture, whether we want to just call it American culture, Western culture, or white supremacy culture. That is pervasive in our society, and that space is something that everybody benefits from and everybody enjoys once they've experienced a place where it is okay to fail.
Well, and that's why you have couches and all your kids come back and hang out with you. But, I mean, it's real though. Like I even had students today. It was really funny. I asked a question and he looks at me and he goes, "Freeberg, I have no idea, but I like your class." You know, I could take that personal. I could get really frustrated, or the way I interpreted it was like, awesome. I built a connection with this kid. He has nowhere else on campus. He knows that he doesn't know. And he's willing to show up and kind of listen. And then, you know, I go through my process and I'm like, okay, here's what you need. You know, let's push through it, blah, blah, blah. And we get him to participate and he eventually gets the answer, right? But just his initial response, like, I've got no idea, but I like your class. It was so funny today. I was laughing.
That's hilarious. I'm wondering if some of that comes from like that in your classroom. And I know we had a whole episode about this. Where like when we talked about modeling, where like you and I like are somewhat intentional and sometimes just like, at least in my case, like intentionally, like unintentionally, like we make mistakes, right? And just owning it and being like, oh yeah, like thank you for catching the error. I will fix that now. And just like admitting that, like, yeah, the teacher makes mistakes. Like, don't try and fake it. Don't pretend that was some intentional thing. It's like, oh yeah, I made this error. Let me fix that for you. Or let me make this correction that I need to make. I think that's really powerful. I've been in a lot of classrooms as a student. I don't get to see other people teach as much as I would like to, so I don't see it as much anymore. But that's probably just a function of my career choice. But where like when a mistake is pointed out by the instructor either gets really defensive or like tries to play it off, like it wasn't a mistake. Like, oh no, I planted that there. I just wanted to, you know, I do that to see if anyone's paying attention. Right? I put a comma in the wrong spot just to see if anyone's paying attention to my punctuation. It's like, no, you made a mistake, right? Like we all make mistakes. We're all human. There's no reason that your kids need to think that you're infallible as a teacher. I don't know where that myth comes from, but that's another thing that sometimes I do it intentionally a little bit so that I can make sure that it's being modeled. But other times, like to be honest, right? Like, I write a lot of my lesson plans at 2:00 in the morning on a Saturday. I might say that there's a connection to the writing rubric, and then the students log in to do the writing assignment. They're like, K-Dub, there's no link to a rubric here. Oh, whoops.
Totally forgot it.
Totally forgot about that. Let me do that now.
Yeah. Please feel free to steal this line from me. I am going to claim it as my own because I'm pretty sure I did not steal this from somebody else, but you can steal it from me. I always say, I've never claimed to be a perfect student. I'm an A-minus kid. I'm going to make mistakes, right? Like, it still, like, has this ownership, and it's kind of funny. Like, it's this ownership of, no, I'm pretty darn good at what I do, and I make mistakes, and it's okay. And it was really funny, like, I think it was yesterday, people might be like, are you just making it up? Like, it sounds like a comedian. It's like, oh, the other day I went to the doctor, right? And it's I actually had a kid that was like, Freeberg, you're making a lot of mistakes today. I was like, I told you, A minus student, it's totally fine. She's like, but that's a lot of mistakes. I was like, what's your grade in my class? She goes, A minus. I said, how many mistakes do you make? She goes, a lot. I was like, perfect. It was another one of those like good moments where it's like, you can make a lot of mistakes and be an A minus student, and that's 100% okay.
Yeah. And like one little thing that I've done in my gradebook, right, is I don't have A minuses, particularly like for that reason, like an A is an A. Like, I don't care if it's a 90% or a 99%, right? Because I don't want you to worry about being perfect. Like, just, you know,
right.
Get an A. Looks the same in the gradebook. The colleges won't know that you missed 5 questions on the test. Not a big deal.
Right. Exactly.
And I'm still trying to figure out a way. I don't know if you've set your gradebook. Have you been able to set your gradebook up to like legitimately reward risk taking and failure? Sorry to put you on the spot, but I have not. So
the what?
I was apologizing for putting you on the spot because I totally have not figured out how to do that.
I was going to say one of the places you can do it. I don't know if you guys use like Infinite Campus or whatever you guys use, but Blackboard. What I mean, there's so many different teacher tools now for grading. Everybody's probably got their own one. But if you build in. At least in our system, if you build in an assignment that has 0 points and then you assign points, it's basically like extra credit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whatever, like if I want them to be able to get like a 2% bonus for risk taking, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Like I would do the backwards math that would say, okay, this 0 point category can get a score of 0 to whatever points based on their level of risk taking, and that's going to be a 0 to 2% bump on their grade at the end of the quarter or whatever. So there's definitely ways you can manipulate the grade books, like there always is. And then obviously there's the standard, like, hey, if you risk take, I'm going to throw 3 points on your test, and you just add it in like on the test. Okay. Yeah. So that's
been my default. So, okay.
Yeah. Those are kind of my go-tos on it. I want to hit real quick too on your comment about like trying to pretend you didn't make that mistake and like try to say it was intentional. Cause I all out myself. I totally did that literally today. Again, I know this makes it sound like I'm making it up. We're doing, and then the reason why is because I'm in a space of teaching right now that is so on point with what we're talking about in this podcast that I'm doing project-based learning. My conversations with the students are as much about non-math content as it is about the math content. And so everything we talk about is relevant in my classroom for the last week and a half. So I've had like all of these experiences time after time because of the way I've designed these last few weeks of the school year. So anyways, we're doing the project-based learning. We're doing volume, and we're doing a street sign today. And if you look at like signposts, right, like the ones that have the little holes in it that holds like the stop sign or the yield sign or whatever, like they're designed in a way that minimizes the amount of steel for cost efficiency as well as weight and all that kind of stuff, right? Well, if you do the basic, you know, rectangular prism and you find the volume on it, it's going to be a solid block. And it was sixth period. I was tired. My kids were being beyond frustrating today. And it was all I could do to get them to do this first rectangular prism. Like, it took them 10 minutes to do something that's length times width times height. I was so annoyed. I was like, plug it in your calculators. Just do it. And they finally, like 10 minutes later, finally come up with this answer. And I totally forgot that I needed to subtract out the rectangular prism on the inside so that you only have the shell of the steel. So it's not this massive, like, barbaric steel pipe you're smacking people, right? And they do the calculations, and the first kid goes, 34 pounds is how much it weighs. And I go, what? Where did they get 34 pounds? And I look back at the board, and I was like, oh, we never took out the inside. And I was like, and instead of like calling out my mistake, I just drew attention to what the student said. I said, is 34 pounds a realistic answer for this situation? And they're like, I don't know. I was like 34 pounds. That's like a third of one of the smaller students in our classroom, right? Like, does that make sense? That's how much that post is going to weigh. And they're like, no, it doesn't make sense. And then it's like, what did we forget, right? And I always use we, because at that point, the students are on board. They're trying to agree with what's getting shouted out by whoever's in the leader of the pack. And then at that point, I own that I made the mistake. I did not stop them or do it. And so I'm part of that piece. So, again, I like to use the we piece to bring it back in. It's like, what did we forget? And they're like, you know, and then finally somebody's like, wait, is that a full steel bar? And like my assistant that's in that group, he's a football coach. And I was like, yeah, that's like if Coach and I strapped on, you know, weighted plates on either side and started benching with it, right? Like that's a 35 pound universal bar, you know? And so then we have fun with it. We play with it. Like, oh yeah, we got to cut out the middle. And I show them the picture again. I'm like, what are we forgetting? So yeah, just, you don't always have to out yourself on it. But I do think it's important to like recognize and take some ownership with the students. It's like, oh no, we made a mistake. What did we learn from this? And what was really interesting is the team of chaos that was happening all of a sudden, like, wait, we were wrong. And for some reason, I don't know why they just all of a sudden got really focused. And for the next 5 minutes, figured out how to find that interior rectangular prism, pull it out, find the real weight. And they're like 5.5 pounds. I was like, that makes much more sense, doesn't it? They're like, yeah, that makes way more sense. And so like, it was interesting how allowing failure and being part of the failing process allowed for almost more focus, more engagement, and ultimately more learning.
Well, that story reminds me of, you were talking about before we started, when we were just kind of bouncing ideas off one another. I think you said it was Will Smith had this quote that you liked or this video that you liked.
Yeah, it was one of your Instagram videos.
I thought it was interesting when you said it, and the story actually reminded me of the thought that I noticed but didn't grab hold of when you were talking about it, is what you're talking about is kind of almost the inverse, at least from my perspective, of the quote from Will Smith, and I'll let you share that story here in a moment. But Chip Kelly has, it's actually not his concept. It's a book that was written by some people who run businesses in Oregon. But for those of you who don't know, Chip Kelly was the head coach at the University of Oregon when they really like went from being kind of an also-ran in the Pac-10, now Pac-12, to being like a national title contender. And it wasn't just the uniforms that did that.
Nike in the locker rooms?
No, and it's actually a book that anyone who's in a position of leadership and trying to build something, I would really encourage you to read. I've read it. It was really great. It's called Grow the Bamboo. And it's about the idea, for those of you who don't know, it was something that I didn't know until I read the book. It's in the intro. Bamboo grows really, really slowly at first. But then once you've created the conditions for it to work correctly or to grow correctly, right, once it's become healthy and you've done all the early intensive labor, it grows at dramatic amounts, like literally feet in months, once you have everything, all the conditions set up properly and everything's ready to go. Like that's why it's such a great renewable resource, and it's being used for all sorts of wood stuff, because it grows at phenomenal rates once you put in the time on the front end. And the reason your story reminded me of that is that if you had just told the students in the beginning to do this problem and then do this problem to subtract the middle of the bar out, the learning would not have been the same. It would have been faster, but the growth that your student showed, the interest in the material that your student suddenly got, we still don't know the reason why, right? You're like, I don't know why all of a sudden they were locked in, but they were locked in, and they learned more from having to figure that out together rather than if you just given them two different equations, said solve for X, and then when you're done with that, solve for X again, and then subtract, or solve for Y and then subtract Y from X, or whatever the appropriate math terms are. I'm a dingus, I don't know.
But I think you're like, just on. You nailed it.
Excellent, good for me. So like that's kind of an example of where like it's a where failure, right? It does take longer if you let your students fail, right? It's not gonna be fast all the time. Now, I think Will Smith has a different concept of that I'm interested to hear your take on, because I think both things can be true at the same time.
Well, and 100%. And I think that the idea that the process of failing as an opportunity to learn and grow does take longer. However, if we refuse to fail, it takes us longer to grow. And I think that's where the two kind of come together. And so, yeah, I heard this on his Instagram one day and I was like, this is like gold. And it was this idea that in order to be more successful, you have to fail more frequently. You have to fail often, fail faster, and then fail forwards. And so that was the idea of don't make the same mistakes over and over and over again. You just spin your wheels and it, you know, you're driving yourself crazy. But this idea of taking the risk, learning from the risk, being okay with failing and failing as fast as possible so that you can finally figure out what works for you allows you to fail forwards so you can grow and become the most successful in your field. Right. And so, yeah, I love that idea, the reframe on failing as if it's not that I am failing that is creating me, you know, the opportunity to learn. It's that I fail so fast, so often that I'm in a continue, like a perpetual state of learning. And so I'm not just going to fail this once, be scared that I failed. Okay, I guess maybe I should learn from this, but I'm so scared of failing again that I'm going to become very risk averse. I'm going to stay out of this. And then I'm going to maybe dabble my toes again later and see if I did it better then. Right. It's like, no, you failed. What did you learn from there? You might not actually have the right answer. You might have thought you learned this, and then you're going to go fail again and learn that, oh, no, that's not correct either. And then, you know, just keep diving in. And so I do agree that the process of failing and learning from failures and struggle and the time it takes to, you know, learn from those mistakes is very time consuming, but if we let those shut us off from ever trying again, I think that is the ultimate failure.
Yeah, for sure. And I would almost argue, you said at the beginning, right, if we don't fail at all, the growth or the learning is even slower. I would say, like, if you're actively avoiding ever failing, you're probably not going to grow at all. We're certainly not very much, right? Like, you're not going to make a lot of headway if your number one thing is not to fail, right? If you're not going to try anything that you think you might fail at, you're not going to try very many things, which leads me to kind of my interpretation of what you're saying about Will Smith is that it's almost like very intentional trial and error with a very long list of things that I'm going to try and continually adding, kind of also adding to that list, like that worked, that didn't work, that worked, that didn't work. I'm going to get some new ideas written down based on different ideas and constantly going with that. And I feel like that idea of constant and intentional trial and error might be a good intro into your story, because your story was kind of a story of repetitive trial and error. All right, folks, quick pause before Tim gets full-blown into his awesome story for this week. Just a reminder to check us out at littlebiged.com for all of the great resources that we are providing in the Teacher Vault. This week, I'm going to be putting in some places to find links to all of those different connection resources, the Kahoot, the GimKit, creating a Jeopardy board, having the bingo set up, and then some reminders and tips about how to turn those resources into tools for encouraging attempts versus encouraging getting correct answers. With that, let's go ahead and take it back to Tim's awesome story.
Yeah. So just to give you guys some framework on this, Dave and I always do like a quick, like, hey, like, this is where we're going, right? Our bullets kind of for our conversation today. And I was like, okay, here's my three ideas for the story today. And when I threw this one out, he goes, wait, what? He's like, yeah, tell that story. So my story, I'll give you the ending and then I'll tell you the build up to it. Cause I think the shock factor and then the wait, how did you even get to that point? is good. So, I lost $30,000 in the stock market in like a matter of like hours, like maybe even less than an hour. And, it came from a desire to grow, a desire to learn and overconfidence. And then frustration and emotions and just, you know, flat out stupidity eventually. Right. And so, I fortunately through a, you know, life experiences had a house at one point in Seattle, sold it cause I was going on the road for challenge day, ended up with some, you know, a bit of the equity from that home sale, threw it in the market, let it ride in the S&P 500 for a while. We were in the bull market at that point. Anything you did was going to make money, basically. And so there's this inflated confidence. And if anybody's ever dabbled in trading, can probably attest to, at first you almost feel invincible, and then when you get it wrong, you're like, well, I got it wrong, but it's going to be right next time, or it's going to be next time. And then, like, that's when you can get into that psychological spiral where, like, there's no way I can possibly lose. Why am I failing? Right. And so, like, you refuse to let that be a learning moment, and you compound your mistakes until it's so painful you have to, like, adjust. And that was where I eventually got to $30,000 of losses. So I'd been dabbling, I'd been playing, I was up, I don't know, probably 20,000, 25,000 maybe from where I'd started after having to just ride in the S&P 500. And then all of a sudden this day hit where, like, I was in and I knew the fundamentals were there. I knew it was going well. And then, you know, like a tweet goes out and it, you know, is adverse to this company. And all of a sudden, like, stock price tumbles. And I'm like, that doesn't even make sense. Like, the company's fine. They're going to do great things. Why? It's a stupid tweet. Who listens to tweets, right? And so I'm, like, fighting the trend, and I'm buying more as it goes down because I'm like, sweet, it's at a discount. I liked it at this price point. It's even better at this price point. And I keep buying, and I keep buying, and I keep buying, and I overextend myself, and I'm trading in margin, for people who know some of the vocab. But basically, I'm playing with, you know, the dealer's money. It's not even my money anymore. I'm putting other people's money on the table. So my losses are not just my losses. It's compounded multiple times over. And before I know it, you know, what should have maybe been like a $4,000 or $5,000 loss was compounded by 6-7 times because I'd been betting with so much money, and it crashed. And then I got scared and I panicked and I pulled away from it. And it, you know, it took a week, a month maybe before, you know, the dirt kind of settled, and then it bounced all the way back plus some, just like I had originally thought it was going to. But because I, you know, didn't have the life experience yet to have that massive loss and to know to, you know, have a system in place, play the parts, all that kind of thing, I eventually just got my butt kicked, pulled out like a lot of investors do when they get scared at the bottom of a market, wait for things to get better. And now all of a sudden I'm never going to get those losses back because I've missed it. And then the market's hot, so you think it's a good time to jump back in. And then you just repeat that mistake over and over again. But I think what is a good story about that is we talk about this idea of experience is like one of these greatest opportunities for growth. And I was having a conversation with one of my students that's been trading on a platform. I don't even know what it is. It's not S&P 500 or Forex, but he's like, dude, my friends got me doing this. He says guaranteed 5% every single day. And if I just, you know, I take my winnings and I roll it into the next day, eventually I'm going to make six figures like in a year with this $200 I'm starting with. I'm like, yes, theoretically. I was like, and you're going to probably have a moment where you let your emotions get the best of you. You're going to probably get greedy because that a lot of us get greedy. It's one of those things that happen, especially when we're chasing money, right? And so he's like, oh, dude, you're right. He's like, I lost $100 yesterday because I got greedy. And I was like, yeah, what did you make when you were following your buddy's trend? He's like, I made like $70. I was like, so you lost $30 yesterday because you got greedy and didn't stay with the plan, right? I was like, I lost $30,000. And he goes, wait, what? And so, like, you know, it becomes one of those life experiences. And this is one of my favorite things about things like our podcast and things like workshops. It, you can take somebody else's life experience that they took in 10, 20 years and condense it into an hour podcast or into a 4-day workshop. And you can save yourself a decade of heartache by learning from other people who have done things and have learned the proven path by failing and not repeating those mistakes. So, yeah, that's kind of my story is just, you can learn so much from it. Like, I know so much about trends. I know so much about, you know, candlestick behavior. I know so much about vocabulary and like why it went right, why it went wrong, why, you know, what I would never do again. Right. And fortunately, you know, I lost on the bounce back on that one, but it didn't keep me out of the game forever. And so this idea of fail often fail faster, fail forward, right? Is I'm back in the market. I'm not day trading. I'm not doing that. I learned from that. And I don't have the time to become an expert at it and dedicate all my time and resources to it. But I am back in the market and not letting myself be scarred from that permanently and not allowing myself to, this year, even through a pandemic, S&P 500 is up 34%. And if I had totally withdrawn myself, I would never have gotten, the gains that happened this year just by being in the market and being a part of the game and playing the game and learning from what I failed at and not giving up, not quitting, right? So,
yeah, a lot of things that we talk in our podcasts in there. I hope, you were talking about the workshop and the podcast, right? You can learn from somebody else's failure. You have to listen and take the advice, right? Like, that's the other thing about, like, when you experience being a great teacher, it's the other reason that experience is a great teacher is people tell us not to do things and we do it anyways. And then we're like, oh, that's why he said not to do that. So I hope for your student's sake that his miniature lesson of losing $30 will, and listening to you about losing more than that will work for him. And thanks for sharing. That's a really great story. And I'm glad that you were able to share it with the rest of us.
You're welcome. We'll see you guys all next week. Always learn in a peak state.
Make it a great day.